All right. Good morning, everybody. Today's daf is Pei Tes. We're going to pick up on Pei Ches Amud Beis. It's about 10 lines up from the bottom, the last thin line. We're in the middle of the story, so we'll just backtrack just to quickly get our frame of reference. The Gemara brought a case of the mother of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, who wrote over her nechassim to Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba in her lifetime, her nechassim milug, and then she passed away. She predeceased her husband, and Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba went to his brother, Rabbi Yirma Bar Abba, to find out, you know, what is the status of this property, and Rabbi Yirma Bar Abba held that it should go to Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, and the gift that the mother or gave in her lifetime was a valid gift. The father, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba's father, Rabbi Abba, went himself to get his own psak. He went to Rehoshia, who went to Rabbi Yehuda, who ruled, he brought in a case of Shmuel and ruled the opposite, that if a woman tries to sell her Nechsei Miluk property in the lifetime of her husband, if she predeceases her husband, the husband can go ahead and take that property back from the Lekuchos after time, meaning that because she doesn't have the full rights of the produce, she only has the remainder of them, because the husband is the one who has use of the field or of the land during the marriage, and so her sale is invalid, and the father can go ahead and take it back from the Lekuchos, and subsequently in this case, the property should be going to Rabbi Abba, not to Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba. Now within that same context, we brought a Mishnah that talked about a father who writes Nechassim, who sells the rights of Nechassim to his son, to be Yoresh after he passes away. And then the son goes ahead and sells, again, his remainder rights, because in this case, the father retained the field to use while he was alive, and once he died, it was going to go to his son. And the son went ahead and sold that ability to, you know, the ability to collect the remainder after the father passes away. And in that case, we have Machlokes, Reish Lakish, and Rav Yochanan. Reish Lakish says that this sale is valid even if the son predeceases his father. Again, in this a similar case, because if the son predeceases his father, then the land, the remainder, does that pass straight down to the Lokeach? Or, because the son never actually inherited it, because he died first, so he didn't have the chance to get the Yerusha from his father, it can't pass down to the Lokeach, and it goes to the father. So Reish Lakish's position is, it doesn't matter if the son predeceases the father or not. In any event, the sale is valid, and the Lokeach would just have to wait till the father passes away, and then the land would pass directly to him. Rav Yochanan holds, no, that because the son, there was never a point in time where the son actually inherited the land, it doesn't go down to the Lokech, and rather it goes back to the father. And we understood that Machlokes to be, we have this case where we have a split ownership. One person owns the right to use the produce, and one person owns what we'll call the Karen, the real principal of the land that's going to be owned, in legal terms, in fee simple, a ownership that's perpetual, that's going to continue to go, not just for the life of the user. So in a case where we have this split, do we say that the person who just has a limited right to use the produce from the field, is that considered full ownership, like a real kinyan haguf, and they can sell it, or not? So Reish Lakish held that the sale goes through even if the son dies first, holds kinyan peros laka kinyan haguf, and that all the father has is the right to use it while he's alive. But other than that, full ownership rights are vested in the son because he gifted it over to the son, and the son can sell those rights just like anything else. But according to Rav Yochanan, he says, no, kinyan peros kinyan haguf dami. So even though the son is eventually set to get that land and have the remainder and inherit that land when the father passes away, until that time, if the father is the one that now has the right to use that field, it is considered as his, and the son has no right to go ahead and sell even his limited remainder right. And that's why, in that context, unless the father dies first and then the field passes through to the son, then it can go to the Lokeach. But if it never passes through to the son because he predeceases his father, then it cannot pass through. So that brings us down now back into the Gemara. It's the last thin line. So we understand the first position, the opinion of Rabbi Yirmiya bar Abba, which was in a case where the mother wrote the nechasim to her son, but the husband right now has the right to use them. So in that case, he held, Rabbi Yirmiya bar Abba said that is a valid gift, because it's similar to the case he aligns with Reish Lakish, that even though the father, the husband, right now has the right to use the land, essentially the owner is the mother, and so she can gift over her remainder to her son, to Rabbi Shmuel bar Abba. So that part we understood. Now we're going to go back and try to understand Reish Lakish within the context of Rabbi Yehuda, who ruled that Rabbi Abba, the father, actually is the one that still is the full owner of the land, because he has the right to use it based on being her husband, and because the gift that the mother gave was invalid, he's now is also the Yorish, because now the mother passed away, and so the husband is the first Yorish. So, middle of that first thin line. Adrula Kami de Rabbi Yehuda. So they went back to Rabbi Yehuda and wanted to find out how he explains his opinion within the context of Reish Lakish. So Amalahu, Hachi Amar Shmuel. This is what Shmuel said, because remember, Rabbi Yehuda brought down a case of Shmuel, and Shmuel's position was, that if a woman tries to sell her nichsei miluk property within the lifetime of the husband, and then she passes away, the husband still has full rights over that, and he can pull that land back from the lekuchos. So how do we align Shmuel's position with the opinion of Reish Lakish, who says that a kinyan peros is lak a kinyan haguf, and just the fact that you have the ability to use it doesn't mean you are the rightful owner or you are the true owner. So he says, hachi amar Shmuel, zu eino dodlum mishlaseinu. The case of Rabbi Shmuel bar Abba's mother is not the same case as our Mishnah, which was a case of a father writing his nechasim to his son. Why not? So my time, but what's the reason in the case of the Mishnah? Amar Rabbi Yosef, bishlama itana ipcha. If the Mishnah would have said the opposite case, which is hakosiv nechasav la'aviv, that not a case where a father is writing the nechasim to his son, but rather the opposite case where the son has property is writing it and saying to his father, I'm retaining the right to use this property now, but it's going to go to you as Yerusha after I pass away. So it's, you know, going upstream. In that case, igla mifshad minei de kinen peros laka kinen haguf dami. I would have understood, and I would have said, that's the opinion of Reish Lakish. It's clear that he's trying to show us the principle that just having the ability to use it, which in this case would be the son's ability to use it before he passes away, then I'd understand that he's teaching us the principle that that is not enough to be a full ownership rights, and you can, and therefore the father, who in this case was the son, wrote the nechasim to his father for after he died, the father is the true full owner. But Elahashta, but this case that we brought, where it's the father writing to the son, Dikataria Kosin Chasav Livno. So what's the reason for Rav Shlakish in this case that says it doesn't matter whether the son predeceases the father or not? In any event, the son has the right to sell his remainder interest. Mishim de Roy Liyarshahu. Because in this case, a son is automatically the Yorish of his father. That's just the general laws of Yerusha. So what is the reason why the father is specifically, in this case, saying to the son, I'm writing over my nechasim to you after I die? He doesn't need to do that. That's the default position. It must be he's trying to give something extra over to his son, and that is the ability to even sell that remainder within his lifetime. But we can't necessarily learn from that in any case across the board that having the ability just to use it is enough to block the remainder person from selling it. So, but this specific case where the father's trying to go above and beyond and give the son an extra right, so that's why Reish Lakish holds in this case that a sale by the son is valid no matter whether the son predeceases the father or not. So Amalei Abaye doesn't like this answer. He says, Atu bra yaris abba, abba lo yaris bra. Is it true that a son inherits the father, but a father wouldn't inherit the son? No, certainly Yerusha would go that way as well. A father is and can be a Yorish of the son. Ella, what must be the case of the upstream case, if you were saying that it's a son writing in a chasm to his father? What's that case? Ella la'avruchinhu l'nichsei mibrei ka'asi. It must be, why would a son be writing the chasm to his father? Because he's trying to bypass the default Yerusha position, where it would go downstream to the son's children. And instead, he wants to say, the son is saying, I want you, father, to inherit my land after I die and not have it passed down to my children. So Hachanami, same thing in our case. The case of our Mishnah must have been a case where there were multiple children, and the father just wanted to stress that this land is going to you, this one specific son, to the exclusion of the other sons. So now again, if we now constructed the case where the father has a specific reason to be writing it to the son, we can then go ahead and learn the general principle that from Reish Lakish that the father's right of use is not enough to block the son's subsequent sale. And again, we have a problem aligning Reish Lakish with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda from our story, who said that Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba's mother, her gift down to Reish Shmuel Bar Abba was invalid, and really all the land should go to her husband, Rabbi Abba. So Ella Mayino Dom. So now we still have to figure out how to align Rabbi Yehuda's ruling with Reish Lakish's ruling. Ella Mayino Dom in the Mishnah Seino. So how do we show that the Mishnah where we brought the opinion of Reish Lakish is a different case than our story case of the mother giving it to her son? Mishum didakanas usha. So no, in this case, we have a special item at play in our story because it is a case of marriage, and we have takanas usha, which we've dealt with previously. Dam Rav Yosef bar Chanina, b'usha iskinu in usha they were metakein ha'isha shemachra b'nichsei milug b'chayi ba'ala. If a woman goes ahead and tries to sell her nichsei milug property within the lifetime of her husband umesa, and then she dies, ha'ba'al motzi miad al kuchos. We give the husband extra inheritance rights, and he can go ahead and take that land back from the buyers. And look in Rashi. Rashi just gives a little color. Last Rashi on the Amud. I mean, even though we don't know the answer of the Machlokas, Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yehuda, and we can say that in general, Akinyan Peros that the Baal has or that a father has is not a Kinyan Haguf, and he doesn't have the right to block a sale of the remainder. However, Baal Benisa Ishto Al Muha Rabbanan Lishibude Mishum Eva Bahavi Kilokeach Rishon. But specifically in the case of marriage, because Rabbanan wanted to keep harmony between the husband and the wife, so they gave a stronger right of Yerusha, and he's treated as a lokeach, not just as a Yerush, but as a lokeach, and therefore, like in any case, if I sell it to one person, then I go ahead and sell it to a second person, the first lokeach has rights and can take it from the second lokuchos, and therefore the Rabbanan were gozer that a Baal's right of Yerusha over his wife's property is that of a lokeach and not just of a yoresh, and therefore if the woman goes ahead and tries to sell the property, the husband can go ahead and pull it back. Okay, so now that we brought up this case of Takana Susha, we're going to go ahead and delve a little bit deeper into whether we do or do not hold of Takana Susha or not. So we are on the second to last line on Peches Amud Beis. Amar Rav Idi Bar Avin, Afanon Nami Tanina. We also learn the same principle where we feel that Takana Susha is certainly in play. Why? How do we see it? Here's the case. Me'idim anu b'ish ploni, shegirish es ishto, v'nasa k'suvasa. Witnesses come and say that this husband divorced his wife and paid off, and he already paid off the k'suva. Turning on to pay test. V'harehi tachtav u'mishavashto, v'nimtzu zomimim. But we investigate a little bit further, or Bezin investigates a little bit further and sees this couple is still happily married, not like the Edom said. And it turns out that two other Edom come, and these initial Edom turn out to be Edom Zomim. So we know Edom Zomim, the punishment is, we do Kasher Zomim, right? What they actually, the punishment that Edom Zomim get is what they intended, the loss they intended to cause to the party. In this case, the woman who they testified against already was divorced and was already paid her ksuba. So What is the punishment that's fitting for these Edom? So, Ein Omrim Yishamu Kol Ksuvasa. we don't say that these eidim have to pay the woman her entire ksuva, right? Because what they say, they said she was divorced and she got her ksuva. So we think, okay, they're trying to make her lose the value of her whole ksuva. So maybe they should pay the full value of the ksuva. We say, no, they don't have to pay that. Ela tovas hana'as ksuvasa. They only have to pay the tovas hana'a, the ksuva. And again, we've dealt with this before. Tovas hana'a is the value that they that the woman could have gotten if she sold the rights to her ksuva, which again is not rights that are necessarily going to be collected. She's not divorced and has a debt payment on the ksuva. She's married and potentially could get paid on the ksuva if she gets divorced or if her husband died. So it's the value, it's sort of the present value of what potentially, you know, the potential payoff if the ksuva, you know, if the ksuva ends up collecting in the end. So, and the mission continues, Ezu tovas hana, who's ksuva. So what exactly is the tovas hana of the ksuva? Omdim kan avad rotsa litein b'ksuva shalzu. How much would somebody want to pay for the ksuva? Shem nis'amla unis'garsha. That if the woman gets widowed or divorced, she would collect the ksuva. V'imesa yirshenabala. But if the woman dies, then the husband would, you know, inherit the ksuva and not have to pay it out. So what would someone pay for the potential payoff? That's the tovas hana, and that is what the eidim are trying to lose her. If we look at the top Rashi, just gives us a little more clarity on this case. If, in fact, this woman had actually gotten divorced, and it wasn't, we didn't go ahead and find that she's married, but let's say we found that she was actually divorced but had not had her ksuva paid, then kimishtachi hanuch, Eidim Zomim, have Musham Lakok Ksuvasa. Then it would have been like we thought. Those Eidim Zomim would have to pay full Ksuva because if the woman was divorced, the Ksuva is really now a debt payment and she's going to be entitled to the full payment. They tried to lose her that full payment by saying she was paid and therefore they would have to pay the whole thing. However, the Balafsude Kulamine de Kamar Nasana, Aval Hashta, but in our case, Shema Ein Asida Litok Ksuvasa La'olam. Maybe she'll never actually inherit the Ksuva at all. Because Shema Tamas, she may die Yerushana Bala. And in reality, it turns out in that case that the Eidim Zomim didn't make her lose anything. So lefichach ein omer misham lo ksuvasa, ela omdim kama adam rotsa litein la miyad b'ksuvasa al hes al hasafek sheim nisam lo nes garsha yitzlena. So rather, we only have to give her what we said as a tovas hana, which is the payment that someone would give on the chance that this ksuva is collected in the event that she is widowed or divorced. Vim tamos. Yerushana bala, but if the woman were to predecease her husband, her husband would inherit the ksuva, muyafsin, and these and whoever would have bought the ksuva would get nothing. Muyafsin mashenasan. V'davim halalu yitnu la ha'edim de tovasana zum afsidin asa miyad. Okay, so that's the case of the Mishnah. Now that's a long way of getting to what our proof is. How do we see from there that Takanas Usha is in play, right? Takanas Usha, that a Baal has stronger rights to inheritance than a regular Yoresh. So these Hagadaitach, Lesel Takanas Usha, so if we would hold, we're about five lines down at the top. Isagadaitach, Lesel Takanas Usha, Amayir Hashana Baal. Why, when the Mishnah was explaining how we value the Tovas Hana, it said if the woman is divorced or widowed, then it would be a full collection. But if she predeceases her husband, the husband collects everything. Why is that the case? Why tazbin ksuvasa lagamri? If we don't hold of takanas usha, which tells us that the husband can pull back the ksuva that was sold to the lokeach in any event because he has stronger inheritance rights. If we don't hold of that principle, then the woman can sell her ksuva rights at any point during the marriage because her husband only has rights to inherit if she happens to predecease him. So if that's the case, that value should also be counted or accounted for as part of the Tovas Hana, because she does have, if without Takanas Usha, a woman has a right to sell her potential, the potential ability to collect the ksuva. So therefore, we see from this case that it must be, we do hold up Takanas Usha, and the only values we have to consider in the Tovas Hana is whether the woman is widowed or divorced, because if she had died, there's no event where the woman predeceases her husband, but that ksuva still has value to the lokeach because the husband will be able to pull it back. Okay, Amar Abai says no. These two cases are not analogous. Im Amar b'nichsa milug, takanas usha is a principle that we espouse only for nichsa milug. Yom b'nichsonu barzel. We can't apply it also to nichsonu barzel. So now, just a quick review: what we learned in kedushin or ksuvas or both. There are two different types of property that a woman can bring into a marriage. When she brings in property, it can either be treated as nichsei milug, which is what we've previously been dealing with, where the husband has full use rights, and he gets the value of the land. He gets a pair of wallets while they're married, and he also gets the value if he appreciates in the land or the land depreciates. It's all on the account of the husband. And the woman, just at the end, will get the remainder, whatever it is after the husband divorces her. The other way to structure it is nechseh tzon uvarzel, where the woman goes in, and at the time that they get married, they evaluate what her property is worth, and they set a value of, let's say, it's 200 zuz, and that value is owed automatically by the husband. So even if something happens to the land, the husband has to go ahead and pay that land and have to pay that value back to the woman. So look in Rashi. Rashi explains why would we differentiate? Why would Takanas Usha only apply in Nifse Milug? Simabru b'Nifse Milug, it's about 8 lines down where it gets thin. Shetucha l'mochron, v'ein abal motzi miyad l'kucho. So in that case, we needed to have Takanas Usha, where it's Nifse Milug. Shaharei impirsu pirsula. Because the woman is the one that's taking the risk of what happens to the value. Because at the end of the day, she just gets back whatever that land is worth at the end of the marriage. So therefore, we have to go ahead and have a takana put in place to protect the husband. But would we really apply that same principle and strengthen the husband's rights in a case of nechseh tzon uvarzel? B'ksuvasa d'hainu nedunya shechnisa lo b'shuma. This case where her property is evaluated at the beginning of the marriage. B'beisavia v'kosvet osa b'ksuvasa u'mekabla alav chasa nachrayas. And in this case, the husband is taking achrayas for that land. He has to return her the value of that land as it was when they entered into the marriage. Then pichsu pichsu lo, then mosiru hosiru lo. Then in that case, right, he's the one who takes on all of the values. So in that case, we wouldn't apply to Takanas Usha. So we don't have proof from that Mishnah. Amar Abai, back in the Gemara. I know we're still trying to prove where that we do hold of this idea of Takanas Usha. Amar Abai, Tovas Hana, Hoil Va'asa Liyadan, Neima Bamelsa. So Bai says, now that we've already brought up this idea of Tovas Hana, I'm going to bring you a nice teaching on how Tovas Hana. So Tovas Hana Leisha Havya. So he says, what is the case? So let's say we do have a case where the woman, if we're talking about Tovas Hana, the woman is able to sell the value or the potential value of her ksuva during the marriage. So let's say we say she can sell that. So does that money go to her, or does it go to the husband? So Abai says, no, it must go to her. Why if you would say that the husband gets that money, gets the value of the Tovas Hana that's brought in, then Lemrula Edim, in our case that we had of the Edim Zomimim, so why don't they just say, Mayafsidanach, Ihavas Mizabaninas Lala Tovas Hana, Baal Habishakaminach. Then the Edom Zomim could say, we didn't cause the husband any loss. Because what did the Edom Zomim say? They said the woman was divorced and she was paid her ksuba. So if you're going to say the loss is the value that she could have gotten on the for Tovas Hana on the market, well, if that value goes to the husband anyway, then the Edom Zomim aren't causing any loss because the woman wasn't going to get anything anyway. Any money she got would have gone directly to the husband. So they shouldn't have to pay anything. The fact that the Mishnah rules that the Edom Zomim need to pay the Tovas Hana value to the woman must be that she does get to keep the Tovas Hana if she were to sell the Tovas Hana of her ksuva within the marriage. So Amrav Shalman, Rav Shalman says, no, we can't necessarily deduce that from here. Mishum de'ika revach besa. Because true, you're right that potentially the woman wouldn't have actually gotten any of the money, would have gone to her husband. However, the woman still benefits from having money come into the household because, again, she's still sustained from the household and any money that comes in is beneficial to her as well. So there still is some benefit there. So even if we said the value of the profits that you get from the selling of the ksuva would go back to the husband, we still can't learn from there. We still would say from there that the Edom Zomim would have to pay something.
That's so, the full amount of that benefit?
The full amount. Seems like it would be the full amount for the Mishnah, but maybe you can make an argument in this case that it would be something less because you're talking about the value that she gets from the money coming into the household. But it seems that it's the full value. Okay. So now back to trying to prove Takana Susha, or that it is applicable. So Kiyasa Rav Papa of Rav Huna, Breid Rav Yeshua, Mibei Rav Amri, Tanina. So Rav Papa and Rav Huna, Breid Rav Yeshua came from the house of Rav. They said this teaching. So Tanina. The Takana Susha. We have another brice that would prove that Takana Susha is in play. Ha'eved va'isha, and this actually is a long way of saying after this last amen and a half, this is why we brought in this whole story. Because this was actually the case from our Mishnah. Eved va'isha p'giyasan ra. Right? If you encounter a woman or an eved, it's not beneficial to you. Why? Hachova behen chayav. If you do damage to them, you are chayav to pay. V'hem shechavel v'acherim b'turim. But if they happen to damage you, they do not have to, they're potter, they don't have to pay anything. V'sagadai techles l'takanas usha. And if we did not hold of takanas usha, again, that the Baal can go ahead and be motzi, the ksuva payment from the hands of the lukuchos, then tis bin nixemi log betitei la. Why don't we just make, we just have the woman, you know, right, what was the issue with why a woman, if she damages someone, cannot pay? Because she doesn't have property. So then why don't we just say, if she's allowed to sell her property, why can't she sell her nisa milug to pay for her damage? So obviously the fact that we say, p'kiyasan ra, that the woman does not have to pay, it must be because she has no access to, she has no access to money, and she has no ability to sell her ksuba. So Gemara's counters, no, l'tameh. Even according to you, even if you do hold up Takana Susha, the woman cannot go ahead and actually sell her ksuba, but still, fine, we still have this concept that the ksuba, even if it doesn't have the full value of the ksuba, it still has some value on the potential collection if the woman happens to be divorced or the husband dies first. So she still has some access to money, so that can't be the reason why our Mishnah says that a woman who damages is not chayav to pay. Ella, what's the reason? De lesla. Must be the case our Mishnah is talking about, a case where she doesn't have a ksuba. So she has no ksuba. She has nothing to, she has no assets to sell. And so similarly, in the case of, in the case that we brought, also, she must not have anything, so that's why she can't sell it. So Gemara answers, all right, well, v'tazbik suvasa b'tovasana v'titein la. Fine, so why doesn't, hold on, let me go back 1 second. Sorry. She doesn't have the ksuva. She has a ksuva, right? Because if she doesn't have a ksuva, we have the problem we said before of not allowing, of Rabbi Meir's problem. This is a case where she doesn't have miluk property to sell. Fine. So if she doesn't have miluk property to sell, then that's the case. So therefore, she has nothing to sell. She can't pay back if she damages. All right. So then we ask our question that we were having previously. All right. Skip the step ahead. Ella must be tazmin ksuvasa b'tovasana b'titinla. So why doesn't she then sell her ksuva? Like we said, why not? Why not sell her ksuva and be able to get that money and then pay the damaged party for that with those proceeds? So now Hamani Rabbi Meir, this is what we brought in yesterday. This is we hold the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Da'amar asur lo la'adam shiisha es ishta afilu sha'achas b'lo ksuva. A woman that you cannot have a wife who's doesn't have a ksuva even for one moment, and therefore we're not going to let her sell her ksuva. So Tamamai, we go through the same line of reasoning as we did before. What's the reason why of Rabbi Meir? Why do we not allow a woman to sell a ksuba? Kadesh lo tia kala be'enav lo tzia. We don't want a Baal to say, listen, I don't have to pay off any ksuba, so it's easier for me to get divorced. It doesn't cost me any money, and therefore it's going to be easier, in his opinion, to dissolve marriage, to divorce her. And we don't want him, we want to, you know, try to put as many obstacles in place that they try to work through the marriage and not get divorced. So, acha, but in our case, the case of not having a ksuva is like you get married, just getting married without a ksuva, because then there's no financial burden to getting divorced. But in this case, it's true that the woman wouldn't collect the ksuva, but if she sold the ksuva to someone else, the lukuchos would still collect the ksuva, and it's still a barrier to the husband. The money is still, he's still going to have to pay that money if he divorces her, so it still serve as the same deterrent, according to Rabbi Meir. So, again, why we still, again, have the problem, why does the woman not have to pay for her damages? Ella, tovasana, mile nenu, mile lamashtabe. So you say, no, in this case, it must be that the tovas hana that she would get from selling this ksuba is only mile, which translated really as words, but what it really means is it's intangible. It's not a tangible object that she can sell. It's something that's to be collected, but it's not right now. It's not right now present. We can't make a shibud to lose lakuchos on something that is an intangible. So I think Mark counters that very quickly. Say, right, why don't we just say, yes, correct, it's intangible, but it's an intangible item that has a value because it could potentially be collected. So true, it's intangible, but it should still be within the context of a sale because it can be sold and it has value. So still, why don't we force the woman to sell that? Ella, Mishim de Shmuel. So it must be because of what we hear from Shmuel. Damar Shmuel. Hamocher shtar chov lechavero v'chazer umachlo machol. Let's say you have a case, not a marriage context, just a general loan context, and the lender goes ahead and sells his debt, sells the right of collection to somebody else. That lender can still go ahead and forgive the debt to the debtor, and the buyer would lose out. The buyer would have nothing. V'afil yoresh machol. And not only that, even if the lender dies, his yorshim can go ahead and cancel. And because of that, we don't want. Let's look at Rashi. Amocher umachol lo machol hilkach. Iamrina la tazabin. If we say that she's selling this potential collection of the ksuba, mafsidin le lokeach. The lokeach is going to lose out because the woman can go ahead and cancel the debt of her husband. Because we forced her to sell the ksuva, she's going to go ahead and absolve the husband of his need to pay that debt, and the lokeach in the end will get nothing. So we're going to she'll get the money to pay the damaged party, but the person who sold it to is going to lose out. He's going to be buying a debt and lose whatever he paid for it. Right? And, sorry, that's a continuation of the Gemara. Amare zvune zavin v'titein lei v'ma... Sorry. So that's what we're worried about. We're worried that she's going to forgive the debt. So now the Gemara counters. All right, fine. Amri zvune zavin, let her sell it, v'titein lei, and then she can pay the damaged party, v'machlele legabe v'al timchala. And if, in fact, she ends up going ahead and being mochel to the husband, fine, she's mochel, and the lokeach lost out. But at least she pays the debt that's right here and now, right? She damages someone. So the debt is in existence right now. So let her do what she can do to pay off that debt. And if it turns out that she ended up messing over the lokeach because lokeach paid for a potential ksuba collection and then she was mochel to the husband, so fine. But at least she paid off her debts that we have right now. So Amri, no. Kol legabe baal vade machlelei. In a regular case that Shmuel was talking about, which is a regular case of a debt, not necessarily is the lender going to go ahead and forgive the debt. Because, you know, if he owed the money, he sold it, it's a regular business transaction. So very likely, nothing's going to happen, and we're going to, the lokeach, yes, there's potential that the lokeach could end up losing out, but in most cases, he won't. In a case of marriage, when the wife has a choice, when we force the woman to sell her ksuba to pay off a debt, she didn't optionally choose to sell. You know, she didn't choose to sell it for some other purpose. We forced her to sell her ksuba to pay off the damaged party. So the woman has a choice of whether her husband should have to pay the money or the lokeach would lose out. Surely she's going to choose on the side of her husband and be mochel a debt. And in order to go ahead and almost certainly make a lokeach lose out, we're not going to do. So therefore, we don't force a woman to sell off her ksuva to pay the damaged party. So v'chitema, all right, fine. So I understand why she can't sell to a third party. But v'chitema zavina niele lehu dechav lebe b'tova sana. All right. So I have a better idea. Why doesn't she go ahead and sell it to the person who she damaged? Right, because in this case, the machla legabe baal lo kamasid. What were we worried about? We forced her to sell it. She's going to go. The woman's going to go ahead later and be mochel the husband's debt, and the lokeach is going to lose out. Fine. So let's not use lokeach. Let's use the damaged party. So right now, what do we have? A damaged party that's owed $100 because of the damage, and the woman has no money, so she's not going to pay. He's going to get zero. So let's make the woman sell to that damaged party the tovas anah of what her ksuva is worth. So he has this slight potential of collecting. And if it turns out that the woman says, you know what, I'm going to be mochel to my husband, he's not going to have to pay. So, okay, the damaged party is in no worse position than he would have been had he just gotten zero from the beginning. At least now he has a slight chance of getting it. So we answer now, sof sof, kol legabe baal vade mochel. Like we said, the woman is almost for sure going to be mochel the payment to her husband. And for this very, very slight chance that the woman may not be mochel and this damaged party may be able to collect the ksuva, we're not going to make Bezin go through the whole process of forcing her to sell, because in all likelihood, he's going to get zero whether she does sell or doesn't sell, so we're just going to keep him with zero from the beginning. So, at the end of the day, that is why we don't, it's not because of Takanas Husha, but that is why we don't force a woman to, or we don't require a woman to pay her damages while she is married. Okay. Okay, now we're going to move on to a bit of a different case. Before we were talking about the Mishnah brought up a case where a wife damaged, a married woman damaged a third party. What about a case where a woman does damage to her husband? Can we construct a case where we would force her to pay for that damage, even though she doesn't have to pay in a case of a third-party damage? So, El, hold it, Tanya. Price teaches us. So, we say the same thing, the same as we say in a third-party. If a woman damages her husband, we do not force her to give over her ksuva, or reduce her ksuva to pay off that amount to her husband. Amai, why not? Tazbinina yela luksuvasa labala petovasa na bahachavla the imachla lagabe bal lekap seda. So why not? What was the problem before with the woman selling her ksuva, or forcing a woman to sell her ksuva to pay for the damage? We said in any event, what she's going to do is eventually just forgive the debt of her husband, and the lokeach, or the damaged party, is going to end up with nothing. But now, in this case, the husband is a damaged party. So either way, the husband's going to make back his money. If we allow her to sell the ksuva, then he gets that. You know, he gets paid for his damages right there. And if she goes ahead and says, "All right, well, no, I'm not going to make my husband pay to my husband, who is now the inheritor of the ksuva, I'll forgive my husband's debt." Okay, great. Then the husband won out that way as well. So in any event, the husband made whole for his damage, either by debt forgiveness or by being the inheritor of her ksuva payment upon divorce, or upon his death. I guess it would go to his inheritors. So why not? This seems to be a perfect construct. Why don't we say that in a case of a woman who damages her husband, she does have to pay for that damage, because she can pay by reducing the value of her ksuva vis-a-vis her husband? So answer no. Havadai rimeirhi. This really gets us into the issue of rimeir. To amar asur la'adam shisha es ishto afilu sha'achas b'lo ksuva. Because when rimeir says you can't have a woman without a ksuva even for a second, because it would be too easy in the husband's eyes to divorce her. Now, v'tamamai, what's the reason? Kadesh lo tia kala b'enav lahotzia. What's the reason? Because we don't want the husband to have an easy time and not have any barriers to divorcing her. Okay, great. What about in this context now, where the husband is owed money because the wife damaged him? So hacha megarish la v'gavei lebechav leminei. In this case, the husband has another out. Fine, he's owed this money because he was damaged. So we're saying we don't want her to sell her ksuva because then it's going to be easy for the husband to damage her. Why doesn't the husband say, okay, great? What do we say about a woman? She doesn't have to pay damages while she's married, but when her marriage is over, that debt comes back into place and she has to pay the damaged party. So in this case, where the husband is the damaged party, so he can say, great, she owes me, she did 100 tzuz of damage right now, so then fine, I'll divorce her, and I'm not going to have to pay her ksuva because she already owes me that money because she damaged me. That debt will then come back into effect after I divorce her, and I'll get paid back for whatever money I paid her in the ksuva. So we now constructed a case where Rabbi Meir's process, or Rabbi Meir's hesitation, doesn't come into play. So yachi hashtamim garish lo v'gabi lei b'chev leminei. So why don't we say? So we're back to square one, where it seems like a good etza. Why don't we just let the woman sell or reduce her ksuva to pay any money she owes her husband in case she damaged him? So we say, no, what's the case here? Kigon de nafish ksuvasa di mishumahu porsa v'masa tuba. In this case, it would make sense if it were a case of a regular del rei seksuva of 200 zuz for a 200 zuz for a sula or 100 zuz for an amana. In those cases, I understand. But let's say there's Tosefes Ksuva in this case, and let's say the Ksuva is really 600 zuz, and the damage is only 200 zuz. So the husband, is just, you know, from a financial point of view, it's not going to make sense for him to say, I'll divorce my wife, pay her 600 zuz, so I can get 200 back in the damage. It's a loss for him. It doesn't make sense. So it must be a case where the Ksuva, the benefit of the Ksuva outweighs, or the Tosefes Ksuva outweighs what the damage is. So the Gemara asks, all right, v'idin fiche ksuvasa miksuva del raisa. If you're right, if we're talking about a case now where ksuva is over the 200 zuz of the del raisa or the 100 zuz of namana, so fine. Now we have a perfect case where we can get around Rimeir's concern. Why? Nukma aksuva del raisa. So allow the husband to keep or the wife to keep a ksuva del raisa of 200 zuz, which satisfies Rimeir. So therefore, it's not going to be kala in the eyes of the husband to divorce her. V'idach tizmin anila v'kavle, and the woman can sell the tosefes ksuva to her husband to pay off the damage that she did to him. So perfect. If it's a case of tosefes ksuva, the woman has the ability to sell that tosefes portion back to her husband to pay the damage, and we still have a Doraisa Ksuva, which satisfies Remeir's concern of it being easy for a husband to divorce a wife. You say, no, that's not the case. The case is Kagon, Delona Fisha Ksuva, Sim Ksuva Doraisa. This is just a set a Doraisa Ksuva of 100 zuz or 200 zuz. But, Tavechavle Arba, this is a very minor damage. The damage, let's say, is 4 zuz, Arba Zuze, Dimishim Arba Zuze, and because of a slight damage of 4 zuz, Lo mafsid esrim mechamisha. And in this case, it's Rashi says it's esrim mechamisha slaim, which is 100 zuz. And talking about the lowest case, the case of an amana ksuva. So again, we're in the same position. We're not talking about a tosefes ksuva. It's just a regular deraisa ksuva. But it doesn't make sense for the husband to sell to divorce his wife to get paid 4 zuz of a minor damage, and then have to pay her 100 zuz in the divorce. Again, it's a losing proposition. He's not making out on that. It only would work in a case where or the damage far outweighed, or at least outweighed, the ksuva payment. Okay, so that's the first. That was the first part of that Mishnah. So Ella Hadatanya. All right, but with that brisa, sorry, continues. The continuation of that brisa is Kishem Shilo Timkor V'Tachtav Kachlo Tafsit V'Tachtav. Just like she cannot sell her ksuva while she's under him, Kachlo, so too she cannot lose out on her ksuva while she is under, while she is still married. What does that mean? Let's see. Rashi frames the case for us. Kishem Shlo Timkor. It's about five lines in the narrow Rashi. This is what we think the Bryce is telling us. Hachi Kamar. Kishem She'eni Yechola Limkor Boda Taktov. Just like the woman is not able to sell her ksuva while she's still married, Kachlo Tafzid Miksuvasa Klum Bishvil Shum Chavala the Nezek Shetazik Boda Taktov. So too, she cannot lose out on her ksuva by damage she does to her husband during his lifetime. And how would be constructed a case where she could potentially lose? V'ha, let's back in the Gemara. V'azimnin, based on what we just said earlier, hazimnin mishkachla dimifsida. We can construct certain cases where the woman would lose out by doing damage to her husband in her lifetime. How? V'echidami could go into nefisha ksuvasa miksuva daraisa. In a case where, let's say she has a high value tosefes ksuva. Let's say she has a tosefes ksuva of additional 400 zuz. So her total ksuva is 600 zuz. She does 200 zuz of damage. We're then in a position where the woman could lose out on her ksuva, because either she should have to sell it, or the husband can say, I'll divorce you, and then be able to collect on that damage that you did, and he'll make out better.
Even if she's not damaging the husband? Or
If she is damaging the husband.
No, he's still losing out the 400.
Oh, sorry. The case where you're right. It's not damaging the husband. It's a regular case. She's selling her tosefes ksuva. That's what it is. She's selling her tosefes ksuva, and therefore she can sell. We're forcing her to sell it, because the issue was she's damaging the husband, but he's not divorcing her, but she has to sell her tosefes because we don't have a problem with Rabbi Meir. The only reason we couldn't make her sell the tosefes ksuva was the problem of Rabbi Meir, where he would then be, it would be Kal in his eyes to divorce her. But if she has a tosefes, she can sell that to pay her damage debt. So don't worry. So in that case, we wouldn't be applied this general principle of the seifa, which said, or we understood as, just like she can't sell her ksuva while she's underneath him, she also cannot lose on it if she damages. So comes Rava and says, no, we misunderstood what the seifa of the braisa was talking about. Amar Rava, seifa asan the ksuvas bin dichrin. Seifa is not talking about a general sale. The seifa is talking about losing out on her ksuva of benin dechren, which we'll go through quickly now. V'achi ketani. This is what the price is saying. Kishem shehamocheres ksuvasa leacherim. Just like if she would sell her ksuva to someone else, lo ifsida ksuvas benin dechren. This idea of ksuvas benin dechren would remain intact. My time is zuzah who done tsuha. Because she is worried about keeping these zuz for her male sons. So let's see what is ksuvas bin dechren. So let's look at Rashi, the long Rashi. Ksuvas bin dechren. Let's start about four lines in from the Rashi. Hayulo, it's towards the end of that line. So what's the case? Hayulo shnei nashim. Let's say a man has two wives. Uksuvas ha'achas gedola mishel chaverta. One of them has a large ksuva, one of them has, regular ksuva. Umesu shnehen bechayev. And both of the women die within the lifetime of the husband. V'yarshan. And he's going to inherit both of their ksuvas because they predeceased the husband. So, o'achas bechayev. V'yarshan. O'achas bechayev v'yarshan. Or just one of them dies in his lifetime. So, afal pikein, what do we say? Lo batla ksuvasa etzal banea. We don't say that the ksuva of either of the wives is batel to her sons. Right? What would we think would happen? The women, they pass away. The husband inherits a ksuva, and all of that money, whether they have a large ksuva or a small ksuva, just becomes part of the husband's inheritance. And then what happens? You have children. You distribute it evenly. You have children from two wives, and then the husband dies, and it's just his full estate, and it's yoresh evenly across the board. But what happens in essence? The children of the wife who had a larger ksuva are losing out because they should inherit a larger piece. So we don't say that. Rather, im yesh laben zachar heimenu ugejaban lachlok banav benachasav achar moso. Let's say after the husband dies, notlan elu ksuvas iman. What we do first is before we get to the husband's general estate, those male children inherit the mother's large ksuva, take it out of the pie, and then you go ahead and split the pie evenly. So the children are not losing out on their larger inheritance because their mother's higher ksuba. The Ashar Chol Mishava, they nicholin bnei akayam as lomar anu nitol ksuvas imenu she kivalas chov. And the same case, same time in the other case. Let's say just one of the women died. You can't go ahead and say, well, our mother died, so we're going to inherit we're going to inherit as a balchov. All right, chika balchov. Atem al tizlush ainly imachum ksuva shaharei baala yarsha. The kaimalon, and this is how we learn the second part of that brisa. Hasam in our case, damocheres ksuvasa laachar betovas hona. If a woman goes ahead and sells her ksuva for the tovas hona price, and she dies umesa b'chai bal, and then she dies in the lifetime of her husband, the yarsha, and the husband is yorisher, mafsid halokeach. So we say the mafsid halokeach, but afal that's takanas usha, but afal pikein lo ifsidu banea. But in any event, even if we say the lokeach loses out, the benin dichrin, they never lose out. So ksuva's benin dichrin stays intact. That takanas usha does not override that, and in this case. That your mother was pasheh. She sold her ksuva. She had a large ksuva. She sold it, and because she sold it, true, the father can go ahead because of takana zusha and take back that and go ahead and inherit that ksuva and steal it and take it back from the lokeach. However, you guys lose out. Now that becomes part of the father's estate and gets split evenly. So we say no. Ksuva's been in dichrin still survives even that. She loyza kayemes loyza gova shara the kuchos hayu gova nosa. So mishum da'amil hu zuzay an suha shayza tzurich alamoz v'lov sidua niskavna. Because we say, what's the reason why the woman went ahead and sold her ksuba? She needed the money. So because she needed money, we're not going to go ahead and make the children lose out. And that same principle we will apply to a case of where she does damage to the husband and she sells her tosefes ksuba to pay that damage to the husband. So even in that case, true, it would pay the it would have to go ahead and pay the damage to the husband, but in that case, we would not lose out on the ksuvas bin adichrin. Those children would still be able to make their claim that the extra piece of their ksuva gets pulled out of the general inheritance, and only then did they go ahead and split with the second set of children the rest of the Yerusha inheritance. I think we'll stop here for now. That's a good stopping place. We'll stop here for now, and we'll continue tomorrow, going ahead further with the machlokas of Takanas Usha, whether we do or do not apply it.
I wanted to ask about this thing.